It's the 16th of March 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, an award-winning podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: should the government release the NHS risk register, and will it reveal simply Andrew Lansley's name repeated over and over again? Are Delia Smith's comments on religion a recipe for disaster? What sort of racket do you need on the Sharia court? Are we on the verge of reforming the libel laws, or would that be a defamatory and possibly actionable claim to make? And if God hates women, why do we really like Ophelia Benson? But before we start this week, some rather exciting news. Last weekend, the QED conference in Manchester hosted the first ever Ockham Awards, the awards of the Skeptic magazine. And stunningly, we picked up their award for Best Podcast, which was nice. So thank you to everyone who nominated us for the award, and thanks to the judges for picking us. But the biggest thanks of all really must go to all of our hundreds of contributors, who, as regular listeners will know, have consistently sent in amazing content week after week, making my job, if you can call it that, of talking bollocks between clever people saying clever things, makes it the most humbling and enjoyable thing in the world. Whilst we're on the topic, don't forget the Pod Delusion has a fairly open submission policy. If you've ever wanted to contribute, head over to our website and drop us a line. But on a more personal note, I'd like to thank our deputy editor, Liz Luckendorf, for being the competent one. Without her, I'd essentially be hopeless. And thanks to everyone who listens, as without you lot, it'd essentially be a scruffy fat bloke who spends a lot of time talking to himself in his bedroom. But anyway, just before we disappear up our own arses, I need to do the begging slot, I'm afraid. So if you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do and don't have any awards to give us, then do head over to our website and make a one-off donation, or subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. All donations are greatly appreciated and are used to help us continue doing what we do. Go on, it's like buying us a couple of drinks a month. Also, we've partnered with Audible, the audiobook people. If you click through to Audible from our website and sign up for a free trial, you can download an audiobook completely free. But you have to follow the links on the Pod Delusion website. Of the many books available, there's the likes of Sam Harris's Moral Landscape, Ben Goddick's Bad Science, or you can celebrate what would have been Douglas Adams' 60th birthday this week by downloading The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But anyway, let's finally get on with the show. We start this week with the NHS Risk Register and the calls that the government should release it so that when they destroy the NHS, we'll at least know whether it was evil or incompetence that did it. Drew Ray, who is an academic studying risk analysis, though, has perhaps a slightly controversial opinion. Don't worry, he doesn't think that The Matrix Reloaded stands up to the original film, but he thinks that the Risk Register should not actually be released. Here's Drew to explain more.
On the 2nd of November last year, the Information Commissioner upheld a complaint about a Freedom of Information request first made in November 2010 regarding the Transitional Risk Register held by the Department of Health concerning proposed legislative changes to operation of the National Health Service, or NHS. The Commissioner ruled that the public interest in disclosure of the information outweighed the public interest in keeping it confidential. So a risk register is the list of things that the department sees to be risky, that they need then to manage to make sure that those risks don't turn into actual bad things. Last Friday, the government lost its appeal to the Information Tribunal, but it still refuses to release the risk register. As an academic researching risk assessment, I have been known myself in the past to ask organisations for copies of their risk assessments. On occasion, I have used freedom of information mechanisms to make those requests. Dealing with health authorities to do this is very frustrating. They are really very good at stonewalling, changing their minds about whether they hold information, and shifting the grounds on which they're refusing to release the information. I can understand the frustration of the person who made the original request and the long appeals process they've had to go through to still not have that risk register released. There is a strong public interest in knowing that organisations responsible for the health or the safety of members of the public are managing risk in a responsible manner. This requires some visibility, not just of the official procedures, but of how those procedures are executed in practice. I don't want to know what it says on paper they're going to do to manage risk. I want to know, what are they actually doing, and are they doing it well? Take, for example, medical devices. It would be nice to know that the procedures for assuring that the safety of something that's put inside you is robust and properly executed. Sorry, you, a member of the public, are prohibited access to that information, because it happens that the government has signed an EU directive that any information pertaining to medical device safety investigation is confidential. That's one of the easy loopholes for government to avoid disclosure of information that would otherwise be subject to a public interest test. All they have to do is sign an international agreement that they're going to keep the information confidential. In the case of the Transition Risk Register, however, I think that there is a strong public interest in it not being disclosed. Why? Because routine disclosure of these sorts of documents, particularly when they're politically sensitive, is going to stop government departments managing risk in a robust, honest manner. If the Department of Health is doing its job managing risk, then of course they will have identified legislative changes as bringing significant risks requiring careful management. We don't need to see the risk register to know that that's probably what's going to happen. And this would be the case regardless of whether the legislation was good, bad, or indifferent. Political opponents to the NHS changes are clamouring for the register to be published so that they can say, aha, even the Department of Health classifies the changes as high risk. Of course the Department of Health classifies the changes as high risk. The subtle point that will be totally lost in most of the commentary is that the level of risk says nothing about whether the changes are good or bad. Big changes are risky. No one with any common sense would deny that. The sensible political argument concerns whether the change brings enough benefit to justify the risk. My personal opinion on that question is based on a theory known as vulnerable system syndrome, formulated by James Reason. James Reason looked at various organisations and the way they behaved in the lead-up to accidents. Key symptoms of an organisation about to have an accident include difficulty in aggregating information, treating people who raised concerns as outsiders, and treating the concerns of outsiders as public relations issues rather than useful information about risk. The NHS under the Conservative government shows all the symptoms of a vulnerable system. Actions which discourage recognition of risk and its responsible management aren't helping the situation. For that reason, I actually support the government's decision to hide the risk register. I just wish they would take the other responsible step and drop the bill altogether. This is Drew Ray, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Over recent weeks, you may have heard our coverage of the debate over secularism, and this week, to the relief of many, TV chef Delia Smith finally weighed in with her opinion that militant neo-atheists and devout secularists are busting a gut to drive Christians off the radar. So it appears that she's been cooking up some bullshit, and I doubt her views could take a grilling. In this next report by Tom Williamson, he's going to try and examine the small brain impulses that would be needed to come up with such nonsense. He's going to question Delia's microwave, if you will. Micro brainwave. These weak cooking puns must be starting to grate. Maybe they need a little seasoning. Here's Tom Williamson with more.
As a fan of Norwich City Football Club, this report on Delia Smith's anti-secular stance is rather troublesome for me. For those that don't know, Delia Smith first found fame in the UK in the 1970s as a TV cook, and she has gone on to sell over 21 million copies of her numerous recipe books. Her wealth allowed her, along with her husband Michael Wynne-Jones, to become majority shareholders of Norwich City FC back in 1996, a position they hold to this day. They saved the club from bankruptcy, and, in this Norwich City fan's eyes anyway, have secured themselves a place in the history of the club, and I still think all Norwich fans owe them a debt of gratitude. Since their takeover, the club have had its ups and downs. You may remember Delia's infamous Let's Be Avenue speech back in 2005, but they are currently riding high in the Premier League, and right now, it's a great time to be a Norwich fan. So, imagine my displeasure when I woke up on the Sunday morning of a recent QED conference to find my Twitter stream awash with messages from fellow sceptics keen to point out Delia Smith's position on secularism. On her website, deliaonline.com, she'd launched an appeal for Lent, aiming to raise money for the Catholic charity CAFOD so that they can deliver clean water to the needy. No problem there, you might think. But it's the following paragraph that has got so many people's backs up. There is a running battle going on in the press, and militant neo-atheists and devout secularists are busting a gut to drive us off the radar and try to convince us that we hardly exist. As a proud secular humanist, I do despair that someone I admire so much could hold such, well, frankly, deluded views. Delia appears to be jumping on the same bandwagon as Tory MP Nadine Dorries, convinced that Christianity is in some way under attack from atheists and secularists. Is there any meat to Delia's claims? When she says atheists are trying to convince us that we hardly exist, she made it clear in a recent interview that she was talking about a survey carried out by Richard Dawkins. The survey in question was carried out in response to the recent census, which asked the rather poorly phrased question, "What is your religion?" The British Humanist Association's census campaign highlighted the problems with this question, and Dawkins' Ipsos Mori poll attempted to straighten it out. The 2001 census came back with 72% of the UK population being Christian, whereas Dawkins' poll put the number at 54%. More than this, Dawkins' poll went into detail and looked at why people ticked Christian. But I think the most interesting finding was that when people who ticked Christian were asked, "Would you turn to your religion for moral guidance?" only 10% said yes. This is not, as Delia Smith would seemingly like to think, an attempt to convince Christians that they aren't Christian, but an attempt to show that Christianity is not as influential as some people believe. Therefore, there is less justification for the religious privileges that are enshrined in UK law, bishops in the House of Lords being a good example. It's not a fight with atheists pitching themselves against Christians, rather an attempt by secularists to fairly represent reality. So, what of secularism? Judging by her comments, it seems that Delia thinks that secularists want to do away with the Christian festival of Lent. What her evidence for this is, I have no idea, but I think it's worth examining what secularism actually is. According to the National Secular Society, secularism is a principle that involves two basic propositions. The first is the strict separation of the state from religious institutions. The second is that people of different religions and beliefs are equal before the law. In other words, it's separation of church and state. It guarantees freedom of religion, which logically means that it allows freedom from religion. So, in a secular society, you are free to be an atheist or to follow any religion you choose. In fact, Delia Smith should be profoundly grateful that we live in a secular society, as she was baptized in the Church of England and converted to Catholicism at the age of 22. If the UK was a Protestant theocracy, she would not have been able to do that. However, we were a secular society, so she could. In fact, you could say that any religious person who values their religious freedom should stand up and be proud to be a secularist. In reporting on what I think of Delia Smith's position on secularism, I hope people don't think I'm being too harsh on her. I think her support of the charity to provide clean water to the needy is extremely commendable and is only a continuation of her selflessness that we've seen in her other charitable work and what she's done for Norwich City Football Club. I'd happily support her statement that secularists and believers have got to work alongside each other, if only it was made clear that you can be both a believer and a secularist. I'd like people like Delia Smith to properly consider what secularism is. I think they would quite happily call themselves secularists if they did. Secularism is vital for our society, and I, for one, will continue to recognise that. By the way, Stephen Fry is a director at Norwich, I'd love to sit in on the next board meeting. Before I finish up here, I'd like to congratulate the Pod Delusion for winning the Ockham Award for Best Podcast at QED, and especially to James and Liz, who put so much work into this fine endeavour. Saying, on the ball, City! This is Tom Williamson for the Pod Delusion.
Now, if you've listened to last week's show, then you'll know that the pro-life protest group 40 Days for Life are back outside the British Pregnancy Advisory Service in London, making a rather unpleasant scene in front of the vulnerable women who may be in the process of getting an abortion. It emerged this week that the 40 Days for Life people are allegedly handing out leaflets, allegedly containing the phone number of an allegedly incredibly dodgy crisis pregnancy centre. And the pro-choice charity Education for Choice have revealed some horrifying secretly recorded footage of some of the alleged advice. To find out more, I spoke to Laura Hurley and Lisa Hallgarten. I started by asking them to give this story some context.
We know that there are lots of people providing pregnancy advice around the country in small independent pregnancy crisis centres. There's no regulation of these centres, so nobody knows what they're up to. And if you try and get information out of them, it's extremely hard to do that. So we have had mystery shoppers go into crisis pregnancy centres and record the interviews that they've had with the so-called counsellors. So the audio clips that we posted yesterday were taken a while back in a particularly bad crisis pregnancy centre, which is one that the 40 Days for Life people are signposting women to.
Are crisis pregnancy centres regulated at all? Is this just basically advice so no one's...
Anyone can set up a crisis pregnancy centre. Anyone can set up as a counsellor and offer advice and information. It's a completely unregulated industry.
Looking at the actual contents of the clips, and it's really quite shocking stuff. So here's the first clip.
But you have to remember that after the way this baby, if you make this decision, this baby will have no life. And also it does in terrible pain.
So the key thing is, it says if you make this decision, the baby will have no life and it dies in terrible pain. Is any of that actually true?
Well, clearly you're ending the life of the fetus by having an abortion. And any woman who chooses to have an abortion or is even considering one does know that. The reason they want to have an abortion is because they don't want to go ahead with the pregnancy. But to talk about it dying in terrible pain is just completely incorrect. There's various views on when pain receptors are all in place and linked up. But certainly, most of that's not happening until somewhere between 16 and 26 weeks in pregnancy. And it's certainly not happening when 90% of women seek abortion, which is within the first 12 weeks.
The second clip is even worse.
So the post-abortion cancer, breast cancer, cervical cancer, ovarian cancer is very, very common now. And they say, from the statistics, with 100, the risk of getting cancer after abortion is 100%. In the UK...
100%?
Yeah.
So you'll definitely get cancer if you have an abortion.
Every year here in UK, from the statistic we know, 40,000 women is diagnosed with cancer. There are many more, but they are not diagnosed then.
So you die.
The problem with the post-abortive cancer is that it's quite aggressive. It's very difficult to treat. And most women die.
It's quite difficult to make out, I think, but the advisor in the clip says the risk of getting cancer after an abortion is 100%. Now, I've never had an abortion, but I'm guessing this is also not true.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that's a really easy one for anyone to see. It's not true. There is a common myth that abortion is linked to breast cancer. Some of the anti-abortion organisations will state that on their literature. Again, if you look at the major organisations dealing with cancer, Cancer Research UK, Breakthrough Breast Cancer, they'll say that there's absolutely no link between abortion and breast cancer.
I think she also said that they were particularly virulent forms of cancer and that you would definitely die if you got them. So pretty much scare tactics. I mean, there's no other word for it.
So there's no science which you could even misinterpret to be this. This is just outright lies.
That abortion will give everybody cancer and everyone will die from it. That's definitely a lie.
So people at these crisis centres, obviously 40 Days for Life, who are alleged to be recommending these centres, are a Christian organisation. Are the crisis centres themselves also of a religious nature?
There are many different organisations operating crisis pregnancy centres, and we have to say this is a very extreme example. Mm. They all do it in very different ways, and some of them claim not to be religious, although many of them do have kind of religious origins. I think that this one is linked to a Christian organisation. We think it's linked to an organisation which has pictures of the Virgin Mary on its website. And when we rang the number that was on the 40 Days for Life leaflet, it took us to the same centre that these recordings were done by, which seems to have a link with something called the Good Counsel Network, although we haven't verified that, and that is a religious organisation.
I mean, the thing that makes me wonder if there was a religious character to it, apart from the link with 40 Days of Life, was in the fifth clip you posted, which we'll play now.
So, abortion is something that comes from the powers of darkness because it's about destroying. Anything that is about destroying, harming, doing evil comes from the powers of darkness, and there are a lot of people on this planet who are under their influence.
And again, if you couldn't make that out, like that said, abortion is something that comes from the powers of darkness because it's all about destroying. I didn't know Peter Mandelson was in the abortion. But have you any evidence on how women react to being told this sort of thing?
I mean, I think it depends how robust somebody is when they seek help. And the unfortunate thing is the kinds of women who are going to go to centres like this are most likely to be the most vulnerable. So we have anecdotal evidence of a young woman who had just left the care system and was pregnant and chose to go to this centre because it wasn't her doctor and because she was fearful of going to see her normal family doctor. And she went with the full intention of requesting an abortion and came back to talk to her social worker and said she would never have an abortion because it was so awful. Now, that might not have been the right decision for that young woman. And I think the problem with these organisations is they do prey on particularly vulnerable women. We have another example of somebody who went to this centre and then went to seek help at an abortion provider, and she was absolutely furious because this centre insisted on taking her medical notes from her.
She was told she'd get breast cancer, and then they took away all her paperwork, including the form that you need to get signed by your doctor in order to access abortion, and told her to come back for another appointment. Basically, these are kind of delaying tactics to ensure that the woman is less likely to be able to access abortion care.
So talk us through what happens when someone goes to one of these crisis pregnancy centres.
As Lisa said, there's a range of quality, there's a range of different services that go on in crisis pregnancy centres. The one which we're talking about today, which the quotes are from, as we've said, is quite an extreme version. In this centre, our mystery shopper was shown quite a lengthy anti-abortion video featuring lots of scary information and images. She was talked at for just over 2 hours, I think, a very long so-called counselling session. And also, if you look on the website, you can see that this particular centre is also offering women ultrasounds. And our mystery shopper was offered an ultrasound, an appointment to come back and have a scan. So we're quite concerned that women visiting the centres may also be having what we don't know if it's registered kind of medical treatment.
Mm.
Yeah, so there's an internet forum where these women are saying that they've been for pregnancy scans there. So we think that they're doing them. I just thought this was kind of juicy. Focus on the Family estimate that up to 75% of women who see a scan of their baby will decide to proceed with the pregnancy. And then this particular centre is saying, we've heard of about 20 women who've decided to keep their baby after a visit to the centre. Some have already given birth. How encouraging to think that these lives have been spared and mothers protected from the trauma of abortion. So that's just an example of a centre using ultrasound scanning and being quite blatant about the reasons for doing so, and to try and persuade women not to have abortions, rather than offering impartial, non-directive advice.
And for important legal reasons, that's not the same centre as the one that 40 Days for Choice...
No, it's another one in the north of the country.
A few months ago, when Nadine Dorries was trying to put through her... thing about forcing people to go to independent centres, does that mean she was essentially forcing, you know, she wants to force people into these unregulated, dodgy advice centres?
What Nadine Dorries was proposing was to take away provision of counselling from abortion providers and to give it to independent providers, which we were very worried might push women into the hands of people who were very unethical and very not really providing good practice. There's now been meetings at the Department of Health between Nadine Dorries and certain other MPs, and it looks like there's going to be a consultation which is going to go out for public... there's going to be a public consultation, and it looks like they're going to promote a kind of compromise position where they don't remove counselling from BPAS and MSI, but they do encourage commissioners to direct people to a range of different services. And we're quite unhappy about that because at the moment, there's, as we said, there's no way of really identifying what's a good service and what's a bad service, and there is no regulation. So for us, even this kind of compromise or fudge actually isn't going to be very good for women.
On that note, we'll leave it there. We'll put links to find out more about Ed for Choice on the Pod Delusion website. Laura Hurley and Lisa Hallgarten, thank you very much. What I find most odd about assisted dying is that a lot of the opposition comes from conservative religious groups. I assume they argue that assisted dying is like redefining the very meaning of the word death. Dying is supposed to be between a person and a bullet, or a person and a horrible illness. Letting other people get involved in the dying process will render all of the deaths meaningless, and all of the already dead people will be retroactively desecrated. Or something like that, anyway. Now, after having talked about infanticide last week, this week Adam Jacobs is back and he's going to come after the old and the infirm. It turns out that assisted dying is some complex business, as he explains in his next report.
This week I'm in bus mode. You wait for ages for Adam to do a piece on the ethics of killing people, and then two come along at once. You may have heard me talk about the ethics of infanticide in episode 126. Well, today I'm going to talk about another tricky ethical issue involving an adult man who would like his doctors to be able to kill him. To be honest, after all the flack I got for my piece about funding for high-energy particle physics in episode 117, I thought I'd be better off talking about safer, less controversial topics. So, ethics of euthanasia it is, then. This week, I heard about a desperately sad case which is going through the courts. A man called Tony Nicklinson had a stroke in 2005, which left him almost completely paralysed. He's paralysed from the neck down, and he's also unable to speak. He can communicate only through a laborious process involving eye movements. His cognitive functions remain intact. It's hard to imagine what a horrible position that must be to be in. Understandably, Tony feels his life is no longer worth living and would like to end it. This is a problem because the only way he could do this without assistance from someone else would be to refuse to eat and gradually starve himself to death. That must be a horrible way to go, so not surprisingly, he's looking at alternatives. And realistically, any alternative means that someone else would have to kill him. So the reason why this is going to court is that he wants the court to rule that his doctors should be allowed to euthanise him at a time of his choosing without having to face a murder charge. There are no doubt some fascinating legal aspects to this case, but I'll leave others more qualified than I to talk about them. I want to focus on the ethics. When considering tricky cases such as this one, ethicists have various theories at their disposal to help them. It's important to realise that none of these theories can tell you what the right answer is, but they can help you to think about the issues methodically and to be sure you've covered all your bases. Two of the most commonly used ethical theories are duty-based or deontological ones and consequentialist or utilitarian ones. Deontological theories assert that you have certain duties and the ethical course of action is to follow those duties. For example, do not lie, do not kill, and so on. Consequentialist theories look at the likely consequences of any action, and if those consequences result in better outcomes for everyone involved than alternative actions, then the actions are ethical. That sounds fine in theory, but it can be much more complicated in practice. It's not hard to find places where one theory or the other clearly doesn't work. To use one famous example of the limits of deontological ethics, suppose I'm sitting at home and a friend knocks on my door and says, "Help, I'm being chased by a mad axe man," so I let her in. A few minutes later, the mad axe man knocks on my door and asks if I've seen the person he was chasing. Deontological ethics, taken to its extreme, tells me I should tell the truth. But clearly no one would think that an ethical course of action here. A quick consequentialist look at the situation tells me that the consequences of doing so are likely to be pretty messy. Obviously the ethical course of action is to lie to the mad axe man. So does that mean that consequentialist theories work better? Well, no. Let's suppose I'm walking along the street and I see a nice wadge of £20 notes sticking out of the back pocket of someone I know to be considerably richer than I am. He's chatting away on his mobile phone, and I know I could just take the money with no risk of getting caught. What does consequentialist ethics tell me about this situation? Well, the consequence of pickpocketing will be that I will gain some money and he will lose the same amount. But since the marginal utility of a sum of money is greater to a poor person than to a rich person, the benefit to me is greater than the loss to my victim. So a purely consequentialist analysis would tell me that it's perfectly ethical to take the money because the net effect would be an increase in overall utility. Most people would rely on a deontological argument that theft is wrong to determine what's really ethical here, and I don't suppose many of you would be impressed with my ethical credentials if I really did take the money. Anyway, let's get back to Tony Nicholson. Some might be tempted to make a deontological argument that it's wrong to kill another human being. However, that does seem rather simplistic, especially given that Tony wants to be killed. Doctors certainly do have a duty not to kill in most circumstances, but they also have a duty to relieve suffering. If killing is the only way to relieve suffering, how are those duties to be resolved? Deontological theories don't seem to be much use to us here, so we should look at consequentialist arguments as well. What would be the consequences of killing him? Well, the consequences for Tony are that he'd be dead. If he believes that his life is currently so miserable that oblivion would be preferable, which is a decision that really only he can make, then killing him would be of benefit. Of course, he's not the only person involved. What about the doctor who kills him? Some doctors would find the deliberate taking of a human life extremely hard to live with. The consequences for such a doctor could be a lifetime of guilt and painful memories. That probably makes it unethical to force any given doctor to participate. Any doctor who euthanizes a patient must surely have to be a willing volunteer. But if a doctor can be convinced that euthanasia is genuinely in the patient's best interests and is okay with taking part, there doesn't seem to be any ethical reason to forbid it from the doctor's point of view. We should also consider the consequences for the family. How do they feel about seeing a loved one killed? My understanding is that Tony's wife is supportive of his wish to die, so there doesn't seem to be a good reason to deny euthanasia on that score. I'm not saying that the family's wishes should trump Tony's own wishes, of course, just that it's one factor that needs to be thought about. Another ethical theory that's widely used by medical ethicists is the so-called four principles approach. Those four principles are autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. I don't really have time to talk about how all of those apply here, and in any case we've kind of covered beneficence and non-maleficence in thinking about the consequences of euthanasia, but I would like to say a bit about autonomy. This is really about recognising that patients have a right to make their own decisions about their own treatment. The default position of medical ethicists is that we should respect patients' decisions. However, as with most things in ethics, it's not quite as simple as that. Before we can accept autonomy as being valid, we need to check a couple of assumptions. The main ones are that the patient's wishes should be based on good information and understanding, and that they're free of any external influences. Suppose someone who's suffering horribly expresses a wish to die. Fair enough, you might think. But what if that person is actually suffering from a treatable condition and doesn't understand the possibility of getting to a better quality of life? Should we respect the wish to die here? Most medical ethicists would think not, because the wish is not based on good information. However, in Tony's case, it does appear that he's well informed. His stroke was several years ago. He's given it time to see if there's a possibility of recovery or of adjusting to his new lifestyle, and at this stage I would imagine that he has a pretty good understanding of his condition, although of course I'm not privy to all the facts, so I can't be sure. Any court that looks at this case needs to be satisfied that his understanding of his condition is accurate. And what of external influences? One of the arguments sometimes put forward against euthanasia is that elderly people being looked after in expensive care homes could be pressured to end their life by relatives, aware that the money that's being spent on care would otherwise become their inheritance. That's a valid concern, and something that any system of euthanasia needs to be vigilant about, but I have absolutely no reason to think that anything like that is going on in this case. So all in all, from what I can tell from what I've read in the media, it seems to me that Tony is making a valid and autonomous request to have his life ended. This is a very tricky ethical situation, and there are many things that anyone contemplating euthanasia needs to think about very carefully, far more so than I've done in a brief piece for the Pod Delusion. But from what I can see of this case, granting Tony's wish for euthanasia seems to me to be an ethical course of action. I do hope that the courts consider this case sensitively and don't add to what must already be an extremely difficult existence for Tony and his family. This has been Adam Jacobs for the Pod Delusion.
Now, libel reform. Long-time listeners will know that we followed the campaign to change the libel laws rather closely. Famously, Simon Singh was sued by the British Chiropractic Association, and this galvanised the sceptical community into doing something about these laws which threaten scientific and journalistic freedom. Last night saw the launch of a new report called the Alternative Libel Project to outline some alternatives to dragging the libel proceedings through the high courts, and also it was the start of the final push to try and get the draft defamation bill into the Queen's speech on May the 9th, which, if they manage it, means with any luck it will become law over the course of the next year. Before the event, I was lucky enough to be asked by Index on Censorship to record a conversation between Hardeep Singh and Vaughan Jones, who have both been sued for libel. Hardeep was messed about for 4 years by a self-styled guru in Punjab in India, who took exception to Hardeep calling him a cult leader. So in a sense, it was a bit like God suing Hardeep for libel. And Hardeep won. Vaughan Jones, on the other hand, is currently in the middle of his libel battle over a review he posted on Amazon, and amongst his co-defendants is Richard Dawkins. But as this is still ongoing, we're going to be very careful about what we say. But nevertheless, here's a clip of the two chatting about libel. You can hear the full version on the Pod Delusion extra feed.
Nice to finally meet you, Vaughan, in the flesh. Wanted to get a bit of a flavour of kind of a background to your case and kind of find out how much time it's taken already. You know, it's very time-consuming, I know that from personal experience.
I received the first claim, well, the claim form, back in on April Fool's Day, funnily enough, and I thought the whole thing was one big joke, and then I finally received the rest of the papers around about the 4th of June, so this has been going on for pretty much nearly a year to the day.
And I guess the stress and, you know, the under those circumstances and for that long takes a toll on an individual. And how do you kind of cope with the kind of immense sort of burden on your shoulders? I mean, what mechanisms do you use to kind of get through this difficult time?
Well, there are a number of things that you can do. Obviously, it's good to have some of your friends and family around you that keep you on the ground, especially when there's quite a lot of complex legal arguments coming your way. Hell of a lot of paperwork. There's no question about that. It's literally thousands of documents to deal with. So I tend to spend time with work it out. I do a lot of strength powerlifting training, so that's kept me quite quite grounded. There's nothing quite as humbling as pulling up 200 kilo from the floor and then trying to forget about everything, really. But I've got some great friends around me, especially Trevor and Neil. They've been really, really great sources of support for me, and obviously we've had a lot of conversations on the phone as well. So it's, like I say, it's great to meet you as well, and hopefully we can come out this on the other side.
I was at a conference this morning and there was a lot of academics and lawyers and MPs talking about, in some instances, how baffling libel law can be. There were suggestions around change in substantive law, case management, improvement in case management in the courts, as well as procedural changes. Now, what's your experience so far of our libel system, and what's most relevant in the proposals that the libel reform campaign are putting forward to what you would see would be a better system if you were to be sued again?
Well, personally, from a personal experience, it's how long it's taken just to get to this point. Because I applied to strike out the case, I think it was sometime in August, and then we finally got around to that hearing sometime in November. And we were expecting the judgment to be released just before Christmas. The judgment hasn't been released yet, so the final hearing is going to be on the 30th of March. So the issue for me is that it's just the sheer amount of time, which is often to be expected in a case with quite a number of litigants, really. There's four separate defendants, a massive paperwork. Honestly, I couldn't explain enough how much paperwork there's been for this case. It's absolutely staggering. So, yeah, I think that from a personal perspective, it's the sheer amount of time. I have been relatively shielded from the complexity of the case, in the sense that I've had some really good legal support that's been able to take me through the different stages. And I'm quite lucky in the sense that I've dealt with a lot of small claims court issues before as a volunteer. And I've seen cases through to different parts of the judicial system. So I was quite experienced with the civil procedure rules, for example. So that when I first received the claim, that was the first place I headed for. And then I received the legal assistance as the case progressed. What I do particularly like is the idea of some sort of, I think it was early neutral evaluation, I think that was proposed, to try and get these issues resolved in a quicker time frame, perhaps, and without recourse to the very expensive courts, really.
No, that's that's kind of the experience of a lot of people that go through libel claims, and one of the things that I think certainly I felt was how it kind of overtook my life over the period of 3-4 years. And it sounds like you're going through that very same experience right now. There's no doubt libel law is extremely expensive and prohibits most people to even come to the door of the court in the first place. So the reform considered by the government includes making libel law up to speed with the internet. And I know your case was one which involved comments on Amazon, on their website. What are your thoughts on these proposals? And these include sort of takedown measures and looking at sort of internet service providers and how they kind of interact with the whole kind of law.
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge that libel law has faced in recent time has been the advent of the internet and the increased use. You have more people, individuals like myself, making comments on a wide range of products and services, and I think to a certain extent that some sites have not really considered the impact of libel law on how they conduct their own services, such as forums, review sites and things like that. A lot of sites are trying to adapt, but without a coherent set of laws behind it, and tending to rely a lot on common law, for example, it's difficult to get to the meat of what perhaps you can and can't say, and particularly with the defences that were available, such as whether you use justification or honest comment, they tend to be found within common law rather than statute, and I think that presents a particular problem. In terms of takedown measures, I think this looks to something that I think Simon Singh called the chilling effect, which is where a site might be tempted to take down something whether they think it is defamatory or not. And I think that's where the major problem is asking someone whether something is defamatory, because obviously the person that's writing something is writing it for a reason. And like I say, it muddies the waters somewhat without anything down in writing, which is saying this is right, this is wrong, this is what you can get away with, this is maybe what you can't get away with. And then obviously the problem of once you get to that stage is how are these sites going to enforce it? Are they going to need to employ more staff? Will people that feel that they've had their products or services or reputation defamed in some way, will they suddenly start carrying out some sort of reputation management exercise where they just try and remove every type of criticism on the internet and websites just giving in straight away because they know the full cost of libel? So there's definitely a challenge there, and I don't really know the right way forward to address that.
Time is running short, so head over to the Pod Delusion website to hear the rest of this fascinating discussion and find links to find out more about the libel reform campaign. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, back in January, whilst some university student groups were getting upset with their student union's approach to satirical cartoons, some genuinely scary shit went down at Queen Mary's University in London. A meeting that was going to be Anne-Marie Waters from One Law for All talking about Sharia law was disrupted when some angry Islamists burst in, filmed people on their phones, and threatened anyone who slagged off the Prophet Muhammad. Needless to say that this meeting was abandoned and the police were called. So last Wednesday, in defiance of these threats against freedom of speech, the meeting was held again, this time with a much bigger audience and with Anne-Marie joined by her colleague, Mariam Namazi. The focus of the talk was on Sharia courts. It turns out that there's two in this country already, which are used for settling family matters. Apparently, in at least one case, a husband lost custody of his kids in a civil court, so took his wife to a Sharia court to renegotiate the terms, which, given what Sharia law has to say about women, probably isn't going to go the woman's way. And this doesn't really seem right, does it? I mean, if they allow this, why not, after trying the High Court, didn't Simon Singh try challenging the British Chiropractic Association on the badminton court instead? But anyway, after the meeting, I managed to grab a brief word with a couple of people to see how they think the meeting had gone. So I'm here with Si from the Queen Mary's Atheist Society, and we've just seen the redo of the Sharia event. Si, you were at the original event. For our listeners who are a bit out of the loop, can you tell us the gist of what happened?
Well, basically, the event was supposed to take place on the 16th of January. It was a completely normal day. None of us expected any kind of trouble. And we were in the auditorium, and we had people from all faiths in the auditorium. It wasn't just the Atheist Society. Just before the talk began, a guy basically walked in with a camera. At that time, neither me nor anyone in the room actually suspected what he was up to, and he basically passed his camera, filmed all of us. And he said if anything wrong or insulting was said against Islam or the Prophet, he said that he knew many of us and he knew where many of us live, and he basically said he would hunt us down. And after that, because of security reasons, we had to cancel the talk.
Well, how threatened did you feel? Were you bricking it?
I was extremely threatened by what happened. I mean, I was never really in a situation like that. I've heard of people being in situations like that, but to actually be there and be threatened by someone was scary. And what was even more scary was the fact that he basically filmed all the audience members and some of us who were sitting in the front row. I basically felt really vulnerable at that moment of time. It's really not pleasant at all. It's terrible.
So that all kicked off. That was a part of the sort of Jesus and Mo saga that went on. We had the rally that we covered a few weeks back, and now we're here back at Queen Mary's. Is this the same room?
No, it's not the same room. The previous room was on the first floor of this building. But this is a much bigger auditorium, and we've actually had much larger audience this time than we had for the previous talk.
So in defiance, you've put on the event again. It was One Law for All speaking. About Sharia, are you pleased with the turnout? Is it nice to see this much solidarity?
Definitely, yes. It basically shows that we're not afraid. On the day, we had to cancel because of security reasons. But today, we showed that we're not afraid and we have the right to speak, right to express our views, and we're going to do it. And that's what we've done. And I'm actually quite proud of the fact that I'm a member of the society, quite happy that the committee, especially Jen, Damon and Rob, they organised this, and full credit to them. I'm really happy to be a member of society and contribute in a really small way by coming here.
So I'm here with Robert Haynolt, the secretary of the Queen Mary Atheist Society, who was chairing the event tonight. Robert, how do you think it went given the circumstances?
Well, I think it went very well. No one tried to kill us this time.
which
is very encouraging. Yes. No, it was a wonderful talk. Both Maryam and Anne-Marie did a wonderful job and made such a convincing argument, and everyone seemed really to enjoy it. And there was a great variety of responses from the audience as well, both in agreement and disagreement, so it was everything we hoped for.
And there was a lot of security tonight. I've never been ID'd going to like a humanist talk before. Who insisted on that happening?
We did. Basically, well, it was decided by everyone, both the university and the society, that we don't want to put our members in danger, but we want to make sure that this thing, that what happened last time doesn't happen again, and that everyone can feel safe and just enjoy themselves without worrying that someone's going to burst in with a camera phone and a mouthful of hatred.
And the actual content of the debate tonight, is this similar to what the original plan was? I take it no punches were pulled.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the original talk was just Anne-Marie Waters. So Maryam Namazi was a very appreciated addition, but Anne-Marie Waters' talk wasn't changed at all. And we wanted to keep it as much like the original talk as we could, because otherwise, you know, the Islamists have won a little bit.
I guess seeing the amount of solidarity from others today must have been quite nice after the ordeal.
Yeah, it was, especially from the Ahmadiyya Muslims, and we're organising a an event with them later this month. So it was wonderful to have those people here and to have people who are Muslims and Christians and Jews, and as well as atheists, because the Atheism Society really isn't just for atheists. It's for anyone who's interested in religion.
Mm. And on that positive note, we'll leave things there. We're thankfully not bruised or beaten up or anything this evening, which is...
No, but if we don't leave the room soon, security may do that to us. So,
Robert Hainaut, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, if you listened to last week's show, you'll know that this month is Women's History Month, and consequently, we're trying to speak to some noteworthy women. Last Saturday at the QED conference, we were lucky enough to spend a few minutes with Ophelia Benson, as Liz Luckendorf explains.
Ophelia Benson is an American blogger and writer who has written about the skeptical meat and potatoes of pseudoscience, but also tackles issues of cultural relativism. Her most recent book, co-authored with Jeremy Stangram, is titled Does God Hate Women? Just a bit of a spoiler, the answer is yes. Very much yes. It is a very hard book to read, as it's a relentless assault of problems relating to women's rights and religion. We sat down with Ophelia at QEDCon last weekend for a bit of a chat about what she does, the reaction to her book, and just a tad about what Women's History Month should emphasize. As Ophelia Benson may not be known as well over here as she is in the United States, I asked her to tell us a little bit about herself.
I edit a website, and I also write for a blog. The website is butterfliesandwheels.org, and the blog is freethoughtblogs/butterfliesandwheels. I've moved over to Freethought Blogs recently, a few months ago. I also occasionally write books, or at least I've been known to write books, and I write a column for Free Inquiry magazine, which is a U.S.-based, secular, reason-based magazine, edited by Tom Flynn, associated with the Center for Inquiry and the Council for Secular Humanism over there. I write an occasional article when somebody asks me to. And most of the time I just geek out online. Pretty much all day, just kind of looking at this thing and that thing and then blogging about it.
And you're here at QEDCon. So what was your talk about here at QED?
It was about religious attacks on free speech, and it was about a whole long list of recent incidents, particularly the stuff at UCL and LSE in reaction to postings by student atheist groups of a picture from the cartoon series Jesus and Mo, and their huge overreaction of the student unions to this very reasonably innocuous cartoon, and also Jessica Alquist in the U.S., who brought a lawsuit against a prayer on a school wall, and she won the case and then was the object of all kinds of vituperation and hatred, and still is, and she gets called names in school every day, and various other incidents like that, and what the implications of that kind of thing are for free speech, and the way religious privilege and religious power get entrenched and distort our ability to use our own reason and our own best judgment about how things are.
And you were also on a, I guess, atheist panel. Do you enjoy those sort of things? Was it there's a whole meeting of minds there. Is that good for you as well? Do you enjoy that sort of interaction?
Not necessarily so much the meeting of minds, although that's fine. But I do like dialogue. I do like finding dialogue more enjoyable than just giving a lecture. And I think actually a lot of people I found this one very enjoyable, especially because Miriam was there, and Miriam is such a powerhouse. But there was actually a certain amount of disagreement among the four of us.
I saw one tweet suggesting that you, Miriam, and Paula could be the new horsewomen of the apocalypse.
Oh, now that's a nice thought. I did suddenly notice. Or re-notice, I must have noticed it before, but it did suddenly dawn on me, oh, hey, there are three women on this panel, one man and three women. That's a reversal of the usual arrangement. Yeah, if anybody wants to elect us the three horsewomen, I'm good with that.
So recently I read a book by Nick Cohen which referenced your book, Does God Hate Women? Why did you choose to write such a book? What was the motivation for it?
I'd been covering an awful lot of religion-related violations of women's rights and attacks on women's rights, attacks on the very idea of women's rights. And my co-author on the former book, Why Truth Matters, had the very good idea of writing a book on the subject. I have to give him credit for the idea.
Were you surprised about anything that you found out during writing it? In your talk yesterday, you mentioned you see like 5 or 6 articles or a day or a week about various issues that you wrote about in your book. I read loads of the blogs that come up as well, but I was like physically kind of taken aback by some of the stories that you mentioned in your book. Were you surprised when you started researching it more?
I wasn't really surprised in a fundamental sense because I had seen examples of the type all before, but when it's put all together, there is a cumulative power in incidents like that coming one after the other after the other. So I wasn't surprised, but I was at least horrified.
Nick Cohen mentions that the reaction to your book, especially from the left, was not as you would expect. Were you surprised by that reaction?
I was very surprised by that. That was downright weird, because what happened is it was the left-wing magazines and newspapers that gave us the worst reviews. And in particular, The Observer gave the book to Christina O'Donnell to review. Why would you give a book on religious hatred of women to Christina O'Donnell when you are a liberal newspaper? I mean, they knew, obviously they knew what her point of view would be in advance because she's very clear about it. And The New Statesman and at least one other leftish liberal newspaper or magazine gave it to people who were sort of already on record as at least being opposed to outright atheism. So the response was predictable. And the best review we got was in the Church Times. And it was not best in the sense of being favorable, but in the sense of totally getting the point and seeing what we meant and not being infuriated by the fact that we were talking about this and just understanding it, being totally fair and saying this is their case, they make their case, and there it is.
So
Church Times.
Why do you think the liberal newspapers did this? Do you think there was some sort of... I'm not a conspiracy, but do you think this says, we'll give it to these people so we'll get some controversy going, or...
No, I don't think it was completely that, but there was more to it than that. Part, probably, the fact that there's a lot about Islam in the book. Now, this is for very obvious reasons. Islam is particularly hard on women. We know that. We just heard Mariam's talk. So I think there was, you know, that thing you see so often of newspapers like The Guardian bending over backwards to be not just fair to Islam, but wildly generous to Islam. So I think they sort of sniffed the air and thought, these people might be Islamophobes. Let's pounce on them.
Based on that reaction, would you consider writing or do you want to write another book on the subject?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't particularly thought of writing another book on that subject, but I would certainly consider it, and I would consider writing a book on quite a lot of subjects. I would also, you know, I would also then procrastinate forever, but I would always consider it.
It's Women's History Month. The thing that I haven't really looked into is seeing how religious groups interpret International Women's Day and things like that. Have you come across anything like what do you think we should be emphasizing in terms of Women's History Month?
I suppose given what I already know, my choice of subject would be, you know, a close look at global women's rights and places where they are the most under threat, because I think that's urgent, and I think people in the developed world and especially the prosperous world just don't know enough about it. I think they often get feminists in particular, for instance, often get accused of just being callous and not caring, and it's not that. I think it's just that they don't hear enough about it, and I think the more people get to learn about that, the better.
There are loads of links you can find on the Pod Delusion website, including the link to Bida's God Hate Women, Ophelia's blog, Butterflies and Wheels, and also Women's History Month events going on in the UK. There are still a few weeks left in Women's History Month, so you can do some research or attend events. I'll be speaking at the Reading University Atheist Humanist Secular Student Society on Wednesday the 21st of March to talk about a few women in UK secular history, and a few from the US as well. It's pretty awesome. There'll be links to find that on the Pod Delusion website as well. This has been Liz Lischendorf for the Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Before we go, a quick plug for the AHS conference in London on Saturday the 17th of March. So it's a bit short notice, but if you do go along, there's lots of good atheist, humanist, secularist goodness going on. You can find links on the Pod Delusion website. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, or even find out how to get involved in the show yourself. Now, if you do enjoy the Pod Delusion, why not support us in what we do by going over to our website and making a one-off donation or subscribing to donate £5 or £10 a month? All donations are greatly appreciated and help us keep doing this week in, week out. It's a bit like buying us a couple of drinks a month. So you can find links to all that at poddelusion.co.uk. And finally, don't forget our partnership with Audible. If you'd like to download a free audiobook, then follow the links to Audible from poddelusion.co.uk and you can download one for free. It's brilliant and super easy, so why not give that a try? The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Drew Ray, Sean Ellis, Adam Jacobs, Tom Williamson, Liz Luckendorf, Blake Hutchings and me, James O'Malley, with much additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. Sketch the Moments by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The other sketch was by Martin Norris. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Since Bear Grylls and his TV show Man vs. Wild has been axed by the Discovery Channel, the man of action has wasted no time, and we believe he's now filming his new series with Disney. We have him on the line now. Bear?
Hello, sorry, yeah. I've got to keep my voice down.
Why? You in the middle of your next great adventure?
Well, you do what you have to do to survive. I can't tell you where I am, but as ever, the format is survival of the fittest in a hostile environment.
Hostile environment?
Have you seen the admission prices?
Or can you describe what's around you?
Sorry, I was just eating a goat's testicle. It was that or the muck at the concession stand. There's large creatures all around, but sometimes you have to show compassion as well as caution. Just this morning I had to put a duck out of its misery. I don't quite know what was wrong with it, but it was agitated, and I couldn't make out a word it was saying. Maybe because they seemed to be tangled up in some sort of sailor's suit.
Couldn't understand? You mean you can talk to animals?
Well, not usually, but for some reason, I can almost understand everything these animals are saying. It's fascinating. Hang on a moment.
Bear, what are you doing?
I'm tired of drinking my own urine. Luckily, I found a different supply. It seems plentiful.
Ha! Pluto! Come away from that weird-looking fella!
Never mind, I'll get him later. Now, I need to make the area safe before I can sleep. I've attached my patented Bear Grylls knife to this cheap plastic wand, making a rudimentary spear, and I've made a camp near the Enchanted Princess Castle.
Bear, that sounds like you're at Euro Disney?
Shh! I can't talk right now. There's some sort of dog-like creature coming right at me.
Howdy, partner. Shucks, it sure is swell to see.
Bear?
It's all right. I've killed it.
Oh, boy. Someone stabbed Goofy.
Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. But I gotta go. It's escalated. There's hundreds of animals all around me. But I'm not going out without a fight. I'll get some of them.
Bear! Bear, don't! I think that's the birthday parade. Oh, the humanity.
Hello, and welcome to that cooking show that is always on. Today we are making that sharing favourite lasagna. Three layers to create one spiritually satisfying Italian classic. Three in one. Firstly, you'll need to make the meat sauce. And it has to be meat, as God gave Adam and Eve dominion over the animals, not vegetables. Start by finely chopping onion, garlic and celery, the Italian Holy Trinity, as they're often referred to. Fry them in oil until soft. Don't let them burn though, that's just for witches. And burnt garlic does go very bitter and will ruin a dish. You then need to brown the mince, the traditional method, and tradition should be enough for you to understand that I'm right, is to use half beef, half pork. Obviously, Leviticus states that we shouldn't eat pork, but hey, we only keep to the laws that support our own petty bigotries. Despite the miracle, that is transubstantiation. Meat really is better here. Wafer just doesn't carry the flavours. When the meat is browned, add the rest of the sauce ingredients. A tin of chopped tomatoes, a splodge of tomato puree thick, like the clotted blood of our risen Lord. A little salt and pepper to flavour. Perhaps a cinnamon stick, which you can remove when the cooking is done, and a quick scrape of nutmeg. Basil and thyme are also nice added to this sauce. Simmer gently, like an archbishop who's just had one of his pronouncements questioned by someone for the first time, for about half an hour, stirring occasionally, perhaps when you feel you're being ignored by the general public. And now onto the cheese sauce. And the only real secret here is to make sure that when you're cooking it, you beat all the lumps out of it like a nun with a ruler. Keep on going until it agrees with you. You need to place the butter and flour in a large, thick-based saucepan. Place it over a gentle heat, stirring constantly. Beat as you would like to a neo-atheist. You only need to do this for a few minutes until those pathetic, weak-spirited sorts accept the glory of God and the flour is cooked out. Start adding the milk slowly and convert to a balloon whisk. You'll need to whisk quite briskly here. Once all the milk is added, continue to beat until the sauce comes to simmering point and thickens. Then, with the heat as low as possible, continue to cook the sauce for about 10 minutes. Once this is done, you can add a spot of cream, a little cheese, and then give it a taste. You'll probably find that it is a little bland, much like Protestantism. So you will need to season. Again, a little salt and pepper, and grate in some more of that whole nutmeg. You may consider adding a little false sense of persecution to the mix. At this point, it's best to preheat your oven. I find that using the pointless hot air that emanates from your standard militant secularist is particularly good for raising the oven temperature quickly. If you can't afford your own organic Richard Dawkins or free-range Sam Harris, then cheaper supermarket versions are available. You can now start layering up the dish. Meat sauce, cheese sauce, then a layer of flat sheets of pasta, then repeat, unchanging and unchangeable. Cover the surface of the whole thing with freshly grated parmesan, not that unholy pre-grated sawdust-like stuff that has the texture of the wool that makes liberals woolly, and place in the oven at 180 degrees Celsius, coincidentally the exact number of degrees most non-believers will turn when exposed to the full joy of this dish that could only come from the bosom of a loving God. For about 45 to 50 minutes, or until it's bubbling and turning slightly golden on top. Leave to cool slightly and then serve to those hungry for the fight in order to sustain them through the running battles ahead. Now, who'll say grace?